Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who don't know, my name is Howard Dodson. I'm director of the Schomburg Center. It's my pleasure to welcome you here this evening, to welcome you to the Langston Hughes Auditorium, to welcome you to the Schomburg Center, and to welcome you to another of a series of collaborations that have been taking place over the last couple of years between the New York City Opera and the Schomburg Center. And this evening I'm especially pleased to be able to say that, without fear of contradiction, that you are privileged to experience what is likely the best entertainment, edutainment value in New York City. Because where else can you go and at one and the same time have an opportunity to hear excerpts from an opera such as Opera X, and a conversation with some of its principals immediately following the performance, and for just $10. Where else can you go? You're fortunate to be able to do that because of the graciousness and support and commitments that New York City Opera has to bringing these kinds of programs and activities to the public, as is the commitment of the Schomburg Center. And so we welcome you here this evening. We know that you're going to have an absolutely wonderful experience. I should say that this is actually the second time that the Schomburg Center has been involved with the presentation of excerpts from the opera X. I think the year was 1987, and we did a performance up at Aaron Davis Hall as one of our Heritage Weekend celebrations back in 1987, and we're pleased to be able to join with New York City Opera again this year in bringing it back to you. So without further ado, please join me at this time in welcoming the individual who is your, certainly one of your patrons for the evening, the general manager and artistic director of New York City Opera, Mr. George Steele.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Howard. Thank you for having us back. It's a great pleasure to be here at the Schomburg Center, one of the great cultural institutions in New York. And a particular honor to be presenting some music from this extraordinary opera, X, to you. I'm sorry to say I did not get to see X on the stage, but I learned this piece from a CD and I fell madly in love with it. And in my way, in love with the composer, a wonderful composer, Anthony Davis, and in fact, he has become, yes. If I remember correctly, this opera, and we'll keep this in mind when you hear it, was his first opera. It is an American masterpiece, and he has gone on to become one of America's most important, if not the most important, American composer of opera. I'm pleased to say we continued our relationship with Anthony and also with championing new American opera. We just read excerpts from a wonderful piece he's working on now called Revolution of Forms, another incredible piece from him, but it's a whole string of successes. I think he's on, I never get this number right, 7 or 8 operas so far, and I hope for many, many more. X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, is a groundbreaking opera. It is, as I say, an American masterpiece. We premiered it at New York City Opera, my notes say, in 1986. After the performances Howard put on. We are very proud of our commitment to new American works, and I'll say to African-American works. The first world premiere we gave was Troubled Island by William Grant Still back in, I think, 1948. We hope to keep premiering American operas. We're at many. Next year there'll be 4 new American operas in our season, 4 works by New York City composers that have never been performed in New York. That is the center of New York City Opera's mission, along with these glorious singers to my right, And I want to thank them and all the musicians for taking part tonight, including the glamorous Christy Swan, who just made her debut this spring as a Suzuki in Madama Butterfly. Yes. It's a wonderful and, as you will see, beautiful cast, Marcia Thompson, Christy, Sidney Outlaw, Robert Mack, and Juan Jose Ibarra, and this very handsome man behind me, Terrence McKnight. We're thrilled to have him again from WQXR helping us out. And I want to thank Bradley Moore, our music director, and Beth Greenberg. And I hope I won't be upstaging Howard if I say for $12 you can get into New York City Opera and see a whole opera. That's our lowest ticket price. You don't get the panel discussion, but I can. You can talk to me afterward. It is a very great honor, and I'm very moved to say that we have Ilyasa Shabazz here in the house, and it falls to me to welcome her to the stage to say a few words to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you to Dr. Howard Dotson, George Steele, to these wonderful singers, Clarice, Sharif, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Thank you for this gracious invitation. It's an honor and a privilege to participate with you this evening. Tonight, I'm reminded that in the 12 short years immediately preceding my father's martyrdom, Malcolm X rose to the defense of African Americans, brutalized by systemic government-sanctioned terror and discrimination. He redefined the American civil rights movement as a human rights agenda, and he united Africa and the diaspora in a singular international struggle for freedom and independence. In my memoir, Growing Up X, I discussed that one of my greatest concerns about the way my family's history is told is the distorted picture that's given of my father's childhood and adolescence. That before he went to prison and discovered the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he was an illiterate deviant who could barely sign his name. But you see, the truth is that Malcolm's parents prepared young Malcolm to be the man that we honor today. And like good parents anywhere, they wanted to provide for their children a nurturing environment in which to grow and prosper, in which to live a purpose-driven life. Minister Earle and Louise Norton Little were dignified, moral, well-read Garveyites. These young activists instilled literacy, accountability, and leadership ideals in young Malcolm and his siblings. The 3 million members of the Garvey movement pledged themselves to do all within their power to conserve the rights of their heritage and to respect the rights of all mankind, believing in the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God. Malcolm's mother was recording secretary for the Garvey movement. She was a well-educated native of Grenada who spoke 5 different languages. Young Malcolm would see her reading, writing, and analyzing the organization's philosophy and literature, and it was she who would encourage her children to read the dictionary from beginning to end. Malcolm's father was a towering 6'4", self-sufficient black man, an upstanding activist minister from Georgia who was also an officer in the Garvey organization. In fact, it was Minister Earle Little who helped secure Marcus Garvey's release from prison for supposed mail fraud in the 1920s. My grandfather was assassinated when he was gathering signatures in Ku Klux Klan territory for a petition to bring the United States government up on charges before the League of Nations for violating the human rights of African Americans in the 1920s. And approximately 33 years later, his son Malcolm X, El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, would garner support from 33 African heads of state to bring the United States government before the United Nations on the very same charges, just as his father did 30 years prior. And so it was Malcolm's parents, Earl and Louise, 2 young conscious activists who initiated his education about the history of Africa and the diaspora. It was they who fortified a healthy identity formation for their children. It was his parents who modeled for him selflessness, compassion, and commitment in the struggle for human rights. It was Earl and Louise Little who trained Malcolm to oppose society's injustices. And so those early lessons of my father's childhood undoubtedly informed his decision to join the Nation of Islam. And in 1952, just a young man in his 20s, Malcolm would become the organization's chief spokesman, and he would be credited with increasing the organization from 4 to 15 temples by 1955 and to 50 temples in 22 states by 1959. Membership increased from several hundred to hundreds of thousands, and the organization's income ballooned to tens of millions of dollars annually. And he would continue his family's legacy of service to humanity when he challenged government-sanctioned acts of terrorism against African-American citizens by the same republic that had subjugated his ancestors in the most brutal form of slavery ever recorded in history. Malcolm abhorred the state-sponsored terror of hoses, dogs, batons, bullets being cruelly and unjustly levied against innocent and unarmed fellow Americans. A bold, courageous, and passionate Malcolm X just in his 20s. He rallied against lynching, murder, rape, and theft of resources and labor. A compassionate young man only in his 20s placed himself in harm's way as he stood to oppose all forms of legalized terror and discrimination with its dreadful consequences of inadequate and unequal access to the economics and politics of society. And by the time of his 30s, my father was revered as an international icon and respected around the world as a brilliant and fearless tactician of unassailable integrity who would not compromise in any manner whatsoever, despite relentless surveillance, harassment, and threats by our government. Malcolm X sacrificed his personal freedom and ultimately his life to aid a nation that would not recognize him or his fellow brothers as men, let alone permit their full and free exercise of inalienable human rights. Malcolm X accepted the mantle of leadership in the civil rights movement because he understood the oneness of humanity, that we are simply brothers and sisters in the family of God. He was able to see himself in each one of us, troubled by institutional and systemic oppression, a nation troubled by miseducation. Malcolm X helped us to understand that Africans of the diaspora were not simply slaves. They were African men, women, and children in bondage, stripped of everything necessary for healthy identity formation, with their connectedness to the family of humanity erased. 30 years after its first publication, the autobiography of Malcolm X returned to number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And today, 45 years after his assassination, Malcolm X remains a role model for millions around the globe advocating an end to injustice in any form. Malcolm was indeed raised by two functional parents in a dysfunctional society committed to freedom, justice, and equality. I'm humbled, honored, and proud to share in the Schomburg Center's 85th anniversary as it also commemorates the anniversary of the life and legacy of El-Haj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X. Thank you.
It is 1931, and the scene is a farmhouse in Lansing, Michigan, the home of the Reverend Earl Little, his wife Louise, and their four children. This evening, the Littles are hosting a meeting of the local chapter of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, the humanitarian organization founded by Marcus Garvey for the welfare of people of African ancestry worldwide. A visiting preacher is recruiting for Garvey's Black Star Steamship Line, founded to transport American blacks back to Africa, their ancestral homeland. Reverend Little still has not returned home. And his wife Louise becomes increasingly anxious because of recent terrorist acts by local white supremacist groups. Her fears lead her to relive past traumas in her life.
Oh,
A white policeman enters, announcing that Reverend Little has been killed in a streetcar accident. But Louise senses the truth, that white supremacists pushed her husband into the path of an oncoming train. After Louise suffers a breakdown, a white social worker arrives and disperses the family, making the little children wards of the state. Young Malcolm, a gifted 6-year-old boy, keeps returning to his mother, pleading for her help. But her illness prevents her from meeting his needs. 8 years later, in 1940, Malcolm's older half-sister, Ella, takes the 15-year-old boy to live with her in Roxbury, the center of Boston's black community. The country boy Malcolm is mesmerized by the brightness and the bustle of big city life, especially its music. In a local pool hall, he meets up with a flamboyant hustler, Street, who will soon initiate him into the world of drugs, gambling, fast women, and crime.
We're making our dance with our sways and our glances. We're taking our chance, taking our chance, taking our chance.
Some men are poor blacks or daughters. Some are lawyers or cobblers. We're all kind of family, almost next of kin. We're just trying to make it from where
your job, play the dice as you got. Shoot your shot, just forget your job, play the number you got. Shoot your shot, just forget your job, play the chances you got.
Some men are strivers with dreams of their own, and some are believers who help a dream along, and some speak of prophecy of Garvey slavery, of nations, visions, and hope. They make the street their church from us.
It's not long before Malcolm is arrested and convicted for burglary. The final scene of Act One finds him in prison, where he begins to examine his life and the forces that have shaped it.
I wouldn't tell you what I know. You don't want to know. My truth is, you've been on me a very long time, longer than I can say, as long as I've been living.
I sold your dope.
called your bootleg, played with hustlers up. But the crime is mine. I will do your time so you can sleep. I won't be out to get you on the street at night, but I won't forget any evil that's right. A hammer coming from the back. It will beat you down when you least expect. I wouldn't tell you what I know. You want the truth. You want the truth. You want the truth, but you don't want to know.
Act Two opens in 1946, with Malcolm still in prison. While his fellow prisoners complain of their oppression, Malcolm is visited by his brother Reginald, a convert to the Nation of Islam, who tells him how Elijah Muhammad, the messenger of Allah, has turned his life around.
My letter, read what I said. I just can't understand what's the game. I've changed. I've found a new way.
One mistake.
He makes one mistake.
met a man who knows all things. No, brother. No, brother. He knows who you are, where you've been. He knows the future.
Lie and take dope. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Alaikum salam.
Bitter and skeptical at first, Malcolm spends his remaining time in prison studying the Quran and Black history, and eventually becomes a believer. Upon his release from prison in 1952, Malcolm follows Elijah's counsel to spread Allah's word throughout the African American community and to renounce his slave name. Malcolm Little is no more. Malcolm X is born, a serious and hopeful man. Act 2, Scene 2 takes place in 1954, right here in Harlem, where Malcolm X is setting up his base and beginning his ministry for the Nation of Islam. In subsequent years, he helps to found Muslim temples in Boston, Philadelphia, Springfield, Hartford, Atlanta, and New York. During these same years, the nation echoes with the names Brown versus the Board of Education, Rosa Parks, Medgar Evers, James Meredith, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In scene 3, it is now 1963. Malcolm X addresses a gathering of Muslims. As usual, he's dogged by news reporters and television cameras. Suddenly, word of a cataclysmic event spreads throughout the crowd.
I said,
Act Three begins as Malcolm is summoned to see Elijah Muhammad, who again accuses him of jeopardizing the Nation of Islam. Now, he censures Malcolm and silences him for 3 months. The Nation of Islam begins to splinter. Though many members follow Malcolm, he feels betrayed and distraught. Malcolm's wife Betty persuades him to make the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, which signifies the solidarity of the Muslim people and their full submission to Allah. Thank you. In Mecca, Malcolm encounters Muslim faithful of myriad nations. Though he cannot communicate with many of them, he begins to feel bound to them in faith. Here, Malcolm becomes ready to renounce his separatist ideas and join the larger community of Islam. Malcolm returns from the Near East, only to be greeted by reporters who accuse him of sparking the violence that erupted in Harlem while he was abroad. He is warned of death threats against him, but he seems untouched by the fear surrounding him. Clearly, Malcolm has returned from abroad a deeply changed man. He signals that change by adopting the name Al-Hajj Malik Al-Shabazz. Malcolm meets with his closest allies to plan their strategy. In order to bring the ideas he learned from African freedom fighters to his fellow African Americans, he founds the Organization of Afro-American Unity and resolves to address the United Nations to air the grievances of Black Americans. As Malcolm plans for peace, violence erupts all around him. Yet he calmly asserts,
"Al-Hajj Malik Al-Shabazz is a man of peace, a man already free. Allah has set me free."
America is all. must keep awake. These men don't wear.
Oh,
February 21st, 1965, Al-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz arrives at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem to address his newly founded organization of Afro-American Unity. His first words to the crowd are,
Assalamu
So what you think?
When is the full production going to be at the at New York City Opera?
Coming soon. Okay. Well, I know you'll want to see the full production whenever it comes forward.
I'm going to ask that Anthony come back on the stage along with Christopher and Rhoda, if you would come up. Thank you. The commercial, while you're while we're getting assembled, one of the things that has been most meaningful to me in my 25 years now here at the Schomburg Center was the effort we put forth and successfully did to ultimately preserve the papers of Malcolm X. And thanks to the graciousness of the family, those papers are here at the Schomburg Center for at least the next 75 years. And as it, fate would have it, we actually have an exhibition on in the our main gallery today and through the end of this year, actually, in which one of the major collections being featured is that of Malcolm X. And so if you don't have a chance to do it this evening, come back and check out the exhibition. It's basically showcasing the collections we've gathered over the last 25 years, and you'll have a chance to see some of the truly extraordinary items that are in that collection, and you should take advantage of that. I'm supposed to be moderating a panel, and there
three very distinguished principals who were involved in making this production possible. And I wanted to actually just start off with Anthony and Christopher asking a rather, for me, probably stupid question, but how did all this get started? The original production was in 1986. Malcolm died in 1965, so it's 20 years after his death. What happened to, first of all, bring him into focus, and second, to decide that an opera should be done on his life?
Okay, I guess I'll start with that. I think we're of a generation after Malcolm. So we were coming up, when we were coming of age and going to school, the autobiography of Malcolm X was be part of the curriculum. And it was something that I studied when I was in college. I worked in the theater. There, I think, are a couple of theatrical productions on Malcolm's life that I performed in. One in New Haven, where we lived in the early 70s. And then I worked on it again and a production out at the Jamaica Arts Center here. My brother and I were pursuing different paths. I was studying acting and working in the theater on the West Coast, and Anthony was here in New York. We've since switched places. And when I moved to New York, he had started collaborating with our cousin Tulani, who's the librettist and a poet, and unfortunately not here tonight. And the three of us used to hang out after Anthony's gigs. And as the evening would go on, we would talk about wanting to do something together, to want to work on a piece together. And anyone who's read the autobiography knows how strong music plays a part in it. And so Anthony and I were talking, and Tulani was talking, and we kept imagining different music for different parts of his life. And that's where the idea began. There are references that Anthony will, I'm sure, talk to you about earlier in having to do with particular types of African-American music reflecting particular historical moments, all the way through what I call the Allahu Akbar chorus, that we really couldn't see any other way. And so that's how we began working on the piece together. And oddly enough, it was in the age of Reagan, which means that if you wanted money, you collaborated with an institution and they would provide you money to write things. They would not provide you money to do things, but they would provide you with money to write things. So oddly enough, in the political climate of the Reagan era, there was money available for opera. I'm not quite sure this is what they had in mind. But being the creative people that we are, we took advantage of the opportunity presented to us.
So am I to understand then that the music came first and the storyline came afterwards, or how did this work?
In many ways, it's simultaneous. Once the idea was born, we all started working sort of on parallel lines, and then we would assemble and decided on a structure where that I would write the story or scenario, and then Tulani would write the libretto, and then Anthony would set the libretto. And because of Tulani's great ear, great knowledge of African-American music, great knowledge of Anthony's music, that she already had in her ear what Anthony would do with it. So that in many ways, she was already anticipating where he would want to go with it musically in terms of how she structured the libretto.
Okay. And Anthony, can you talk a little bit about the, you have a very broad musical palette, if you will. What specific elements of that palette did you find most useful in trying to interpret this story?
Oh, I think, I think what's so great about opera is that you can use everything. I mean, and I felt, you know, when I was doing this in writing it in 1984 and 1985, I was so exciting for me because I felt that it was a completely open space. I could draw on anything that I knew about in music and put it into the opera. And I think that you seldom have that kind of freedom when you can write something and, you know, no one really knows what you're going to do. In fact, I didn't know what I was going to do either. So it was very exciting because I kind of discovered how to compose an opera as I was doing it. And I had a lot of help working with Rhoda, who has had so much experience with opera and working particularly with new opera and ideas of, you know, also with Christopher and Tolani, certainly, about how to create a structure for the piece. And previously, Tolani and I had collaborated a lot. We did a number of pieces at the Public Theater in the Joe Papp days. And what we were doing was being prompted with Andazaki Shange's piece for Color Girls, the emergence of the choreo poem. And so I did a lot of work. I worked with Zaki as well as Jessica Hagedorn, a number of the poets in the New York scene, and I created music for the poetry. So actually, I started my first collaborations with Tolani were creating music for poems that she had already created. So I already knew how to kind of set a scene, create a scene, you know, a scene around the language, and also working so intimately with her language. And that really helped me in trying to create an opera because I already knew how to create the mood for the language, and also the rhythm of her language was so important. And she is so, her words are so musical, and she thinks so musically. So that was a very important part in the evolution of the piece. And then for me, then learning how to set text to music which I found was such a joy because I'm a frustrated writer myself. And so this allowed me to get back into a world that I was already kind of familiar with. You know, the fact of dealing with language, dealing with words, dealing with images. That was something that I felt very close to, and I felt I could do musically. And it allowed me to really find my own voice as a composer. And now it's harder for me to write instrumental music because after writing, you know, I'm now working on my seventh opera. I found that, you know, I love language and I love working with it, and I love the fact that opera gives you the opportunity to move outside of just the abstract world of music into the more concrete world of drama and action.
Okay. So I have this other question. That maybe is the production that will be done at New York City Opera the same one that was produced in 1986. Have there been any changes?
Well, I think that what we did do was not expensive. We did it with a chain link fence and basically just objects. It was like a garbage heap in which we emerged with the opera. But it was wonderful, and the actors were extraordinary. I met Tony at the Kitchen. I don't know if you know what that is, but it was a place where people created things. It was wonderful. And he started telling me about X, and I will never forget, if you don't mind my telling this, he would call when we decided we'd do that together, and I talked with Harvey Lichtenstein and with Beverly Sills, and they were quite interested in helping us. But our process was sometimes like this. The phone would ring at 4 a.m, and I'd jump up, and it would be Anthony. And he'd say, "Hey, Rhoda, I just wrote beautiful music." I'm sure that's true. And he said, "Listen." Then he went into another room and played. And I sat there, and I heard something vague.
My neighbors love that.
Yes, yes. And I heard something vague. And he said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "I scarcely know what to think, but I'm sure it's wonderful." And how we and when we were, our first lab was in at the kitchen, and we had wonderful singers. And I'd say, you know, Malcolm's father was killed, and the group was distraught and distressed, and then came beautiful music. So, and I couldn't figure out what to do with it, so I asked the company, because I always work in collaboration with the actors. And so we didn't know what to do, so we sat there. And then Priscilla Baskerville, a wonderful singer, stood up and said, "I think I'll walk around." She played Malcolm's mother. So she walked around, and the music was beautiful, and she looked at me and she said, "Why am I doing this?" And I said, "I don't know." And she sat down. Well, ultimately, what happened by going through that process was that Anthony decided to write the aria for Malcolm's mother.
Yeah, well, we had the, yeah.
It's that kind of process that happens.
No, it was interesting because, as I said, I was learning how to do this, and that was the exciting thing. And I had the advantage of having workshops, and I think I wish that young composers had the same advantages I had. To really try out some of the ideas. And a lot of it was, I have to say that what I had studied before and what I really knew in opera was Wagner, which is really, might seem really bizarre to everyone. But I was at Yale. I was in a class, Robert Bailey taught this class. It was supposed to be 19th century music, but it ended up being Wagner. You know, and he did Weber, was the first part of the 19th century. Then it was Wagner, and then a little bit of Strauss, and that was the class. So as a pianist, I was horrified. You know, I said, "What happened to Chopin?" You know, you know. But I sort of force fed this opera, and I became really interested. So I started writing parodies of Wagner. So I wrote this science fiction suite in which I wrote out all these leitmotifs, and I, you know, showed it to the class and everything, So I was kind of fascinated by the form, and then I was introduced earlier in high school when I was in Italy. I studied I read a lot of Nietzsche, and I had this wonderful teacher who was, he had come to Italy to become a priest, and he fell in love with a beautiful woman and decided that he couldn't be a priest. So he ended up being my English teacher and my philosophy teacher in Italy.
And he came to the production in 86, came backstage.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And it may be all his fault, because when I was taking this philosophy class, it was in 10th grade in Italy, he gave me The Birth of Tragedy to read. And so I read Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy, and reading that book, I was so excited. I said, "Wow, I mean, this Dionysian, the Apollonian, and this, you know, the binary, and the idea of, you know, the music of the spirit of revolution. I mean, I'm down for that. I'm ready. I'm ready for that." And then the idea of combining, you know, the structure of the Apollonian and the passion of the Dionysian. And I began to think about it. I said, "Wow, this isn't German music. What is it?" And I said, "This is American music." He didn't know what he was describing. This is the relationship between our kind of our culture, which combines the classical and jazz. It combines the music of the African diaspora and the improvisational spirit of music that we have, that's so much a part of our culture, and also wrestling with the structures and forms of old Europe. So I felt that opera in America could be better embody what Nietzsche was describing in Birth of Tragedy than actually German opera could. And so that became a kind of mission to me. You know, if, as a 15, 16-year-old, I began to think about, "Hey, when I get, well, someday I'll write an opera." You know, I had no idea. You know, I didn't have any of the tools to do it, and it took me quite a bit of time before I was ready to do it. But in X, and Malcolm's life was so great, and I was so excited because I thought, well, he's our Siegfried, he's our tragic hero, he's our hero, he's the person who went through the fire, who went through a transformation, and to come out on the other side. I mean, I felt that this was such an important story to be told, and it was truly operatic in scale. And I remember when Christopher first spoke to me about the idea of doing a piece of Malcolm. He was in a play, El Hajj Malik, at Yale. It was in New Haven. And so he came backstage and he said, man, you should write a musical about Malcolm X. So I looked at him and said, a musical? I said, what, are you going to have the Dancing Fruit of Islam? What is that? I said, I don't really see the musical, you know, Malcolm. And he had this idea. And he said, no, but he had this great idea, like, you know, the parallel, the idea of the development of this African-American music through, as paralleling the political and social development. So, and it's all in the autobiography. So I said to him, well, this could be an opera. This is an opera. And that was so, because to me, I think, so that was an exciting step for me. And also, I thought we could wrestle also with our musical history, too. So when you hear Allahu Akbar come to life, I'm thinking about John Coltrane. I'm thinking about McCoy Tyner. I'm thinking about a whole period of music in the 1960s that seemed to me to be about this kind of revolutionary spirit, the spirit of trying to breaking out from the conventions of song form or the conventions of standard tunes or bebop. So to me, it was exciting to always go back and forth between bridging this idea of representing this musical history, which I think is embedded in our political and social struggle, and realizing the parallels between the two. And then also trying to discover my own voice as a composer, I try to integrate all these things into something that can be coherent and cohesive.
Oh, that's wonderful, thank you. Yes. Well, I'm going to ask you just a very basic question. Who was the original cast? And what were some of your challenges as a director with that cast?
Well, there were no challenges because the first Malcolm we had was a man named Avery Brooks. And yes, one of the most brilliant men I've ever worked with. I was just blessed. There are some performers when you're a director you work with and they walk out of your head, like Stratus or Anthony Dean Griffey. They're just extraordinary, and Avery was that. And we had a wonderful cast. We had Priscilla Baskerville. We had so many people.
I think it's interesting to see how the piece was actually transformed by the talent that we ran into.
Oh, yes, quite.
And
it always
I think
is.
Anthony will tell you a little story about Thomas Young.
Well, actually, what Rhoda said isn't quite true, because the first Malcolm actually was Peter Lightfoot when we did the workshop in Philadelphia. And Avery was Street. Avery came in to do Street. But he was you haven't seen charisma until you see Avery Brooks. Avery Brooks, when he was here, he just took over the stage. It was ridiculous. I mean, and plus, there are things in the character. For example, I have this whole thing, you need a zoot suit, a conch, and a pad. Yeah. That's sort of I was thinking a lot about Fats Waller and how Fats Waller would he was in a way our first rapper. You know, he would do it as, you know, your feet's too big, or he'd start talking and playing the piano. And so I had the stride thing going on, and Avery, I said, well, you know, and it actually wasn't originally in the libretto, and Avery started improvising this stuff. Like he said, oh, so he started improvising this kind of street poetry in which he's talking about, you know, and then he would improvise in between in other parts of the street thing, so it made it really come to life. But it was so powerful as Street that no one noticed Malcolm, you know. I mean, it was ridiculous. And I said to Avery comes up to me and says, well, Tony, What do you think? I said, well, I think I better have you be Malcolm X, right?
Tony, also, the young man who did the child Malcolm when we were in Philadelphia was...
Savion Glover.
Yeah. And what he would do, he was just brilliant. what he would do in the when we had breaks, he'd go out on the street and break dance and tap. And
yeah.
I swear he made more money on the street doing that.
Yeah. He was unbelievable. I mean, also his timing, he was just like when elegant. All of a sudden, he'd do this pose. So, No, but we had some incredibly talented people. And then when Avery took the role of Malcolm, where we did, I remember doing the workshop at BAM, and Avery would improvise in between, in the middle of the music. He would say stuff. He would set things up in terms of the staging. So, for example, he was doing the scene up, which is based on about 125th and Lenox Avenue, like he's the street corner minister. So he said, "Man, you have to have an interracial couple walk by. I want to harass them." And he said, hey, fella, you better pull your coat. You know, and he would just improvise stuff. It was unbelievable. So the thing, he captured, the wit and humor of Malcolm in a way that was so great. I mean, and the spontaneity, thinking on his feet, being able to respond to. So when Rhoda was working, she would set up things that would allow Avery to improvise.
I think what directors do are the ones that I happen to like a lot. Like Ingmar Bergman, they do it in collaboration so that you learn to, you work with actors, but you also learn to listen to actors as they listen to you. And you always come up with something that's exciting and thrilling because we all work together, and that's very important, I think.
And then the second stage is once Avery had moved over and left Street behind.
Became Spencer Beam Hawk and Spencer for Hire. That's what happened.
Right. Then Anthony heard Thomas Young.
Yes. Yeah.
And came back and said, "I'm going to entirely rewrite Street. Street is now a tenor, and he is going to become Elijah Muhammad later because this man can do it all."
And it was interesting because it created an antagonist in the opera that would go through, because before we had Street in the first act and he disappears, and then you have Elijah Muhammad in the second and third act. But in effect, it created this kind of, I call the false father figure, I think, and I think I looked at it kind of as seduction that he's seducing Malcolm into the life in the first act. And then bringing Malcolm into the Nation of Islam in the second act. So it made sense for me to have the same person play both parts.
Well, this is very all news to me, thank goodness. And it's wonderful. I really, really appreciate it. Most of your operas have been very political. Do you believe that operas have to be political?
Oh, no, they don't have to be political. I think it's...
Do your operas have to be political?
No.
Well, they have to be about something.
Right, about something, yeah. I mean, I think because you know, I'm politically aware, and I think sometimes you have to be aware of where you are, and and I think operas are so big that they speak to the time, you know, and that's very important. I think some of us... We just think that opera is this abstract thing that has nothing to do with it, with what, you know, what we're thinking or what we feel or what's important in our lives. That's insane. That seems insane to me. So I think that politics certainly for me is part of that, because whether it's, you know, dealing with the issue of slavery in Amistad and you know, we kind of had a different kind of subversive look at that story. And then, or, you know, Native American people in Wakanda's Dream. I mean, I think it's important. I'm always aware as an artist that what I'm representing and what I'm saying, and that it's very. And I also look at art as a subversive act. I mean, that's part of why we're here. We have to speak to power. I mean, I think that goes back to when my friend Henry Louis Gates wrote about the signifying monkey. It's a way we have of speaking and signifying and speaking to power, so that we can play a subversive role in addressing the power structure in America, and that I think that's I take that very seriously as an artist, and I think that's, you know, part of why we do this art. it's not, and music, I mean, I love music, of course, that's why I do it, but it's also about moving people. It's the idea that music can take us beyond ourselves into realizing something else. And I think that finding that something else has to do, and the subject matter I've taken with my operas is also trying to discover and look in a different way at who we are and where we came from.
It's like finding yourself in what you see for the audience. I also want to say that some of the singers were wonderful, but also the instrumentalists, two of whom are here, mm-hmm. Earl and JD, were so influential in creating this music.
Stand up, man. Yeah. Earl's looking in the room. Earl. Oh, that was fantastic, because when we did the opera in City Opera, there weren't that many black faces in the orchestra, let's put it that way. So it was really interesting for me. You know, I part of the deal, doing the opera, is bringing in I had a 10-piece ensemble of improvisers who played in the pit, and they were so important, because the improvisation is, as I said, it goes back to the first days when I first was looking at Nietzsche and reading Nietzsche and thinking about what opera could be. I mean, the improviser is essential to me, because the improviser, to me, is about that spontaneous energy and I think that that's so important in my conception of opera and what we're doing and how it's presented on stage. And these artists, I mean, JD particularly, I mean, he's so fantastic at, I mean, I remember when we were doing X, and you did that introduction to Malcolm's aria at the end of Act One that they sang today. And there's a pedal point. JD does this solo with bowed vibraphone, and he was doing multiphonics and stuff. So he wanted to look at the score, because he wanted to figure out how to incorporate the whole score into the solo. It was very interesting, because I said, well, JD, wait a second. You can't, that can't be an overture for the whole thing. but it was so exciting, because I think all the musicians took playing the opera so seriously, because they were trying to integrate their talent, their ability, and their creativity into making something a whole, something cohesive, something that works together. And that's been one of the great experiences of my life, is working with these musicians in the opera.
Yes. Yeah. I remember the improviser who was playing trombone said, "I need to see the stage. I'm responding to what happens on the stage."
Well, there's an old adage that if you give them too much, they'll expect more. And I think you all have gotten your $10 worth.
Thank you.
So I want to thank all of you for coming out this evening. I thank our panelists. I thank our musicians. It's been a wonderful evening, and we look forward to collaborating with New York City Opera again on another project. Thank you all again, and God bless you all.